The next case is 06-1155, Jane Doe versus Archdiocese of Cincinnati. In this case, Justice Lansinger has recused herself. We're pleased to have sitting in place of Justice Lansinger, Judge Julie Edwards, the Judge of the Court of Appeals, sitting in the 5th Appellate District. Welcome, Judge Edwards.
Thank you.
Mr. Vanderlaan.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Mark Vanderlaan for the Archdiocese of Cincinnati. This is a case which we submit let me say that I'd like to reserve 2 minutes. That we submit, had it been held in the Court of Appeals for perhaps 1 month, we might not be here today. Because if we go back in history and examine this court's decision in Doe versus Archdiocese of Cincinnati, and I'm sorry, we'll call this one Jane Doe and the other one Doe, that opinion was released on May 31st, 2006. The Court of Appeals opinion in this case was released, I believe, on May 5th, 2006. So the Court of Appeals from the First District did not have the benefit of this court's analysis of statutes of limitations, did not have this court's views with respect specifically to the whole issue of equitable estoppel. We submit that this case presents a classic example where a prior decision of this court serves as precedent, where the language utilized by the court serves as a sound basis that warrants reversal of the judgment below. Specifically, the issue here is what is sufficient for equitable estoppel as a means to overcome the statute of limitations. In this case, the acts in question occurred some 38 years before a lawsuit was ever filed. And uniquely in this case, I say uniquely because in looking at the cases examined by both sets of attorneys in this case, have found nothing similar to what we have here as a basis for equitable estoppel. Because what we have here is a classic example where the actual alleged tort, what forms the tort itself, according to the court below and to the appellees in this case, or the appellee in this case, is one and the same. And it is statements made about the advocacy of adoption prior to the adoption itself. The tort itself or the claim itself is that somehow the relinquishment of the parental right then created some cause of action for the plaintiff in the case. Now, what we learned, I think, from Doe versus Archdiocese and what this court cited specifically in terms of the language from Zampano versus Quinn from the New York State Court of Appeals was that there has to be specific and concrete action taken after or subsequent to the events that gave rise to the claim itself that would convince the plaintiff not to bring a lawsuit within the time allotted by the statute of limitations. Whatever statute of limitations we're looking at in this particular instance, the longest appears to have been 4 years. How it would have been viewed in 1965, in other words, whether it commenced at the time that the plaintiff reached the age of majority at the age of 18, or whether it started when the relinquishment of parental rights occurred when she was 16, doesn't make much difference in this particular
counsel,
instance.
In the other Doe case, there were allegations of or claim that the RICO statutes applied, that the reason the statute ran is the church actively covered up what had transpired, and therefore, and that was...
That was one of the claims.
That was one of the claims. I think I felt that was the most compelling of the claims in terms of getting past the statute. That's not present here, is it?
Correct, it is not. The claims here that survive, at least, appear to be breach of fiduciary duty. Again, one of the claims from the original Doe case, an intentional infliction of emotional distress, and some kind of loss of familial relations. but there is no RICO contention, never was in this case.
Okay.
Let's come back to it. The issue here is that, and what the court found compelling was that as they put it, the archdiocese, that's not important for today, but I would submit it was not the archdiocese, but rather individuals who happened to be religious in nature, one nun and one former priest, made statements, the priest apparently stating to the plaintiff that if this child's not put up for adoption, I probably can't be a priest in the future. The nun saying a number of things, all of which are very much intertwined with the whole concept, and I would submit maybe her own personal concept in some instances of scripture and religious belief.
Well, this is a 12B6 case, am I right?
It's 12B6 case, so we are confined to the allegations in the complaint, but they're there.
And really nothing more than that. Should we not perhaps let the record get developed before we do this? Or is there enough precedent from our first Doe case that controls this?
There's certainly enough precedent from the first Doe case, because what the first Doe case taught, and that was on a 12B6 status as well, Your Honor. What that taught was that the allegations of the complaint have to be sufficient to show why, and very specifically, why the statute of limitations wouldn't apply. In the first Doe case, you did get into the whole question of equitable estoppel, because it was argued, as it's argued here. In this case, they have some specific allegations, perhaps even some at least facially more specific allegations than might have existed in the original Doe case. So yes, this is ripe for analysis at this stage.
Counsel, in the previous Doe case, I think it was established that a plaintiff has to establish that there were subsequent and specific actions by the defendants that somehow kept them from timely bringing suit.
Correct.
And my understanding is that there was no subsequent actions. In other words, there was a course of conduct once the pregnancy was discovered and she was placed in a home, and then the child was relinquished for adoption soon after birth?
Yes.
And then this young lady went back, presumably, to her family?
Correct.
And finished high school and et cetera, with no further contact from the father of the child or the Sister Mary Patrick, or the diocese. Is that correct?
It's correct. There's no allegation whatsoever about that.
And as far as subsequent actions, I didn't read anything that said, you know, please don't bring a lawsuit here. And if you bring a lawsuit, you're going to go to hell. I mean, there was none of that.
No.
Intimidation or coercion or threat.
Correct, and this is why I say, if you look in the precise language that was utilized by this court in Doe, and actually other courts, the Cuyahoga County Court of Appeals in the Livingston case, the Butler County Court of Appeals in A&S versus Fairfield City School District, you know, where there are specific statements, please don't bring the lawsuit or please keep it secret, they held that wasn't even sufficient. But here, there's not even a discussion or mentioned about lawsuits or claims of any sort.
Which brings me to the next point in paragraph 16 of the first district's opinion, where it says, after reviewing Doe's complaint, we conclude that these statements adequately allege that the Archdiocese conduct was motivated by a desire to prevent Doe from bringing suit. And I guess that's the crux of the analysis here, is how do you get from the pleadings, with no mention of subsequent specific activities, to the conclusion reached by the Court of Appeals that the activity, the conduct, was motivated by a desire to prevent Doe from bringing suit?
With due respect, there is none at all. They have not articulated any. There's certainly none articulated in the complaint in the case. As we know, there were no statements about lawsuits at all.
But in the pleadings, I guess it's alleged that the conduct and the actions taken by the Archdiocese, quote, were calculated to and resulted in Ms. Doe's relinquishment of her parental rights and forbearance of any legal actions.
That's not sufficient, however, because, again, if I think it's probably safe to say that almost anybody would wish that they not be sued. And even saying, boy, I really don't want to be sued, somehow does not give rise to the imposition of equitable estoppel that somehow waives a statute of limitations for some 38 years to allow a plaintiff to choose when they wish to then pursue a claim.
But there was no allegation in the complaint that the word suit or foregoing legal actions or consequences if you do, none of that is the basis for any of the paragraphs in the complaint. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
And I think the court below, the First District, made it clear that what they were doing was trying to draw an inference that looking at all of that, somehow they would make that leap and infer that somehow it had something to do with lawsuits. But again, I'm not sure how that can happen when there's no discussion of lawsuits by anybody at any time.
Counselor, though, can't you perceive, and I know this is a hypothetical, of a situation where the equitable estoppel doctrine would be expanded, and I know it's not the exact fact situation here, but say you have a young woman who gets pregnant or beaten up by a very prominent man, and he says, you know, if you ever tell anyone, if anybody ever knows I'm the father of this child, I will harm this child. I will harm the child. Now, he doesn't say, I don't want you to file a lawsuit, but certainly implicit in that is that would be a way that the public would find out about it. Would that be enough in your mind to expand the doctrine of equitable estoppel?
For one thing, I think that would be a criminal act as opposed to a civil issue. But
I understand. But if
bringing
a civil suit, and he says, if anybody ever finds out I'm the father of this child, I will harm the child.
Not if we understand equitable estoppel in the context in which it has been used by the courts in Ohio and apparently other courts of appeals throughout the land, where equitable estoppel is a doctrine that's to be employed after the cause of action arises. Not where it is here. It's alleged to be basically part and parcel of the cause of action, apparently. Again, I think you might have to look at different cases in different contexts, but I'm not sure that would even fit.
Your argument, is, and the best argument is to stick with what we have, the subsequent and specific action. I understand.
I've exceeded my time.
Thank you, Mr. Vanderlaan.
Thank you.
Mr. Mezebov.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. If I might immediately address Judge Edwards and your hypothetical, we agree with you. The principles of equity asserted by Ms. Doe are so well established that we do not believe it can be seriously disputed that a party who figuratively places a loaded gun to the head of an injured party or an injured party's loved one and threatens that individual if he or she divulges the wrongdoer's identity or brings some legal claim against that person, as grounds to stop this person from disclosing all of this, that person would be estopped in equity from later on asserting the statute of limitations if that person was in fact deterred. In other words, if in fact the wrongdoer got the benefit of his or her threats. Here there was no loaded gun, literally, but figuratively there was.
But that's an expansion, really, of the doctrine as it stands and what we have before us and what this court has already decided in the previous Doe case.
Honestly, I do not believe it is an expansion. And with respect to the question of whether this issue was decided earlier in the previous Doe case, I think with respect to the doctrine of equitable estoppel, what the previous Doe case stands for is that equitable estoppel is a viable claim in the state of Ohio. There are well-grounded elements, well-established elements.
Well, counsel, I don't think anybody's arguing that that is not a possibility to have the presence of equitable estoppel, but in this particular case, where are the subsequent and specific actions by the defendants that kept that somehow kept them from timely bringing suit? Once this young lady, who was apparently 16 at the time this all transpired, became an adult, what stopped this plaintiff from bringing action?
Justice O'Connor, I think there are a couple of questions really implicit in that larger question. I'm going to attempt to answer them both. First, with respect to the language of subsequent and specific acts, that language is borrowed, I believe, from the Zampano case. I believe this court alluded to Zampano in Doe and borrowed that language from Zampano in discussing the Doe case. Zampano, much as the earlier Doe case, differs from this case in this very material way. In Zampano and in the original Doe case, the archdiocese was being accused of concealment, of not doing anything. And in Zampano, the New York Supreme Court was saying, look, we have sex abuse. The subsequent acts you're accusing the archdiocese or the church of is doing nothing. Well, doing nothing is not a subsequent act. There was no affirmative obligation, at least according to the court, for the church to step forward. Here, the subsequent act that was missing in Zampano, an affirmative act, is the very tort in question. There is an affirmative act here. The affirmative act was, if you do these things, your child will not be baptized. Your child will not be cleansed of sin, and these other statements. There is no need in this circumstance for a subsequent act. The affirmative act here satisfies that criteria.
But once the child was adopted, presumably the new parents, I'm presuming it went to a Catholic family since it was placed through the archdiocese, child was baptized, became a Catholic child. That was what the whole objective was. Where's the continuing threat here?
We don't know that. That's not in this case. That's not in the complaint. Nowhere in the complaint is there a description of who the adopted parents were. It's irrelevant to a decision here. Those are facts which the archdiocese would like you to infer. But as a court, you cannot infer that, and I as an attorney cannot allege that.
So you want us to infer that the subsequent and specific actions would be the statement or the belief by, I guess, one of the sister Patrick, that, this child, it can't be baptized if it's not given up for adoption. That's the crux?
That was the statement and the gun, so to speak, the figurative gun that was put to my client's head.
And if that was the alleged gun, right here.
You are, I'm sorry.
If that was the alleged gun, then why do we not circle back into the separation of church and state where you have statements of religion which may be genuinely held by the nun, and they are statements of her religious belief? How do we judge those? How do we tell whether they're true or not? How do we separate religion from facts in this case?
Your Honor, it doesn't matter whether those are sincerely held religious beliefs. The test here is not whether they are sincerely held. The question is whether those sincerely held beliefs were used for a very secular purpose, namely.
So anytime a pastor will counsel a young lady about adoption and make statements similar, those are actions, all those counselings all now become actionable later if she decides that she really didn't want to give the child up?
I don't think in that circumstance the priest or the counselor is conditioning the advice on an affirmative on the individual relinquishing the rights to bring a legal claim. If he was doing that and he were trying to intimidate or harass or coerce this individual into something, that would be a misuse of legitimate church doctrine. But here, implicit in Your Honor's question to me is the assumption that these are sincerely held religious beliefs. That also is not in the four corners of this complaint. That is an assumption which can only be determined, I suppose, later on if we had to go there, and I don't think there's any reason to go there because we don't have to investigate whether these are sincerely held religious beliefs.
Why not?
It's enough that our client was, her will was overborne by these threats. If
sincerely held religious beliefs are actionable, regardless of whether they're sincerely held or not, why isn't that intertwining religion? You're saying it doesn't matter. She felt threatened by them. But if they were sincerely held, then is that really a threat, or is it simply an expression of a religious belief?
The fact, if the nun actually believed that to be true, and perhaps she did and perhaps she didn't.
Let's assume for the sake of this argument
the
she
purpose,
did.
But if the purpose for causing my client to... If the purpose she gave that information was to cause my client not to go to court or divulge the parentage of her child, that's a misuse of the religious belief, whether it's sincerely held or otherwise. It doesn't matter. If an individual is going to lose a baptismal opportunity or the baptismal rite, that should not be used as the cost of he or she going to
court. So if the nun sincerely believed that this child might not be baptized if it was not placed for adoption because it was, quote, in the Dunn's version, born in sin, that becomes an actionable threat, even though that is not the motivation of the nun. The motivation of the nun is religion.
Fair question. No, motivation is important here, and courts always have traditionally investigated the motivation of individuals for certain actions. So certainly, if these are sincerely held beliefs, that would affect an analysis of whether her motivation was truly religious or whether it was something else. But whether or not...
Is she available anymore to testify? The nun?
The nun? I'm not sure because we haven't gotten there. I don't know.
Counsel...
But her... I would say her writings are available. There is documentary evidence. And again, this is a 12B6 analysis. So everything that's in the complaint must be assumed as true. And I want to be clear on this point because Your Honor has raised a very important question. If these are sincerely held beliefs, that is a factor to be considered in whether or not there was fraud and misrepresentation and abusive conduct here. But it's an element that has to be ferreted out in a factual analysis and not determined on the face of the pleadings, which is what's happening here.
Counsel, I want to come back to the 12B6. Apparently the operative facts that are alleged in the complaint that give rise to the hope for some award of damages are this business about if you don't do this, if you don't be quiet, if you don't place the child for adoption, no baptism, and those consequences. That's basically the complaint is not about making the church responsible because some priest got a
This is not a sex abuse case.
Yes.
The thrust of the wrong here is that a child and a mother were separated forever.
And the priest is now dead.
Correct.
So some of the problems that occur from a long running statute of limitations are certainly present in this case.
Unquestionably.
Now, with respect to equitable estoppel, does that if there is equitable estoppel, does that run forever, or does that become a question of fact and law as to whether or not at some point your client has waited too long and shouldn't get the benefit of equitable estoppel because she waited too long.
It should be a question of law and fact.
All right, but that, you argue, can't be determined at a 12B6 level. It has to go further.
That's correct. There should be an assessment by a fact finder as to the reasonableness of the application of equitable estoppel.
Did
you plead that? Did you plead the reason for waiting?
Yes, that she was deterred because of fear of these consequences. I guess the question is...
Well, but 38 years later, this child is probably got grandchildren at this point.
That's as much a reflection as the effectiveness of the threats as it is the laxity, if you will, of pursuing legal rights.
Okay, but your argument is...
You can assume either one.
Your argument is the question of the length of equitable estoppel can't be determined ever at a 12B6 point. It has to go on and have some evidence developed on that question.
If you have properly pled the elements of equitable estoppel, that's correct. Equitable estoppel should apply as long as it is equitably reasonable to do so.
But your argument runs counter to the decision that this court has already put out in Doe versus Cincinnati.
Your Honor,
it was a 12B6, and we discussed equitable estoppel.
Your Honor, that was a concealment case. The same principles apply, but the application of equitable estoppel
would it make
be
a difference
here.
What the cause of action were? You compare the causes of action?
As I understand the claims in the original Doe case, sex abuse had occurred with a number of individuals, priests and children. And
the principle that I'm trying to establish is you're arguing equitable estoppel to us.
Yes.
Justice Pfeiffer's explored, this is over a 39-year period now.
Correct.
And you're asking us to write a rule of law with respect to the application of that, which we've already done in another case.
The case
on a 12B6. And so the development was the same there as it is here. Equitable estoppel applied there as it is argued here, well argued, and why wouldn't we be controlled by our earlier precedent?
Because the previous case in Doe did not rest or fall on the equitable estoppel doctrine. There was a decision that the statute of limitations should not be told in that case based on the discovery rule, and that was a concealment case. Was the archdiocese guilty of concealing facts which would justify tolling the statute until certain facts had been discovered? We're not alleging that.
Wasn't completely relying on concealment, because one of the statements in the opinion, which I wrote, was that the child knew, and as an adult, he knew. He knew he had been abused. He knew who the priest was. He knew those facts. So the knowledge was there, just like the knowledge of your client was there as to all these things that had occurred. And we still applied on a 12B6 at equitable estoppel.
The difference in that case from this case, in that case, the plaintiffs were not claiming that they did not go forward against the archdiocese because they had been affirmatively scared off from doing so. Here, that's exactly the claim, that the wrongdoing of the church was affirmative, it was specific, it was pointed, and it was intended to deter us or prevent us from ever filing a lawsuit. So there's a significant disparity and difference in the facts which gave rise to those decisions. This case was not litigated in Doe. If you had been, you would not have been dealing with concealment and discovery rules. That's what you were dealing with earlier. You're not dealing with that here. You're dealing with a course of conduct that was calculated and pointed to get the result it did.
Counsel, in the complaint, do you allege who actually made statements to the plaintiff here?
With Father Heil and Sister Mary Patrick. Yes.
That specifically asked her to forego legal action?
No, we did not.
Or a lawsuit?
No, we did not.
Was there any offer of settlement alleged here?
Your Honor, I would concede there was no offer of settlement. There was no discussion of the statute of limitations.
No discussion of any civil action whatsoever.
I concede that there was not. What there was a figurative gun to their head, which the church knew would have this effect. It was they intended it to have this effect, they reasonably believed it would have this effect, and they relied on our client's acting as she did. That is all alleged in the complaint. That's enough to make out an equitable estoppel claim for purposes of moving forward to discovery.
Why wasn't the church's conduct here directed at convincing Ms. Doe that she should adopt the child and nothing else?
I have no idea why the church wanted to do that, except
apparently. That's the way the case seems to me to be. Nothing was done to prevent her. Nothing even led to prevent her to file a suit. It was to convince her that she should adopt the child instead of having the baby born and keeping the child.
No, she was to give up the child.
Right.
She was.
Oh, give it up or whatever.
To give it up.
Yeah.
Never disclose the parentage.
Adopted then.
Never disclose the parentage of the child, and if she didn't, the child would not be baptized. But it was clearly an effort, and it goes on. The priest would no longer remain a priest. It would hurt the church.
But what does that have to do with filing suit? That has nothing to do with filing a suit.
The filing suit is the same as disclosing the parentage of the child and revealing the church's wrongdoing. That was clearly the thrust of the complaint.
The implication would be that's...
And that's what the Court of Appeals so held, applying conventional and traditional principles. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mithiboff. Mr. Vanderlaan, you've saved about a minute and a half of your time.
Let's come back to basics. There is nothing at all, as I think Justice O'Connor has established from opposing counsel, that shows any statements of any sort made after the cause of action actually became ripe. The entire concept of equitable estoppel, as established by this court's precedent and as articulated by courts of appeals throughout this state, the elements simply are absent. The quote unquote gun to the head, which I would take exception to.
Even figuratively,
is still, I think, as we see, rife with issues of religious interpretation. And it's not just the religious interpretation or the sincerity of the beliefs held by Sister Mary Patrick in this instance, who died 30 years ago. It also includes what would be a necessary examination of the sincerity and the depth and the meaning of the religious beliefs held by the plaintiff in this case some 39 years ago. First Amendment does not allow that type of intrusion.
Could I ask one factual question that I didn't get from reading the briefs here? Were the parents involved with this decision, the 16-year-old's decision?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Vanderlaan. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal, please adjourn court.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye.